Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific Daylight Time. If you have a question about the Bible or about Christianity, or you have a difference of opinion from something you've heard previously on the program, a difference of opinion from the host, that is, you're welcome to bring it up right here, right now. Our lines are open for you at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. If you'd like to be on the program today, I'd be very glad to talk to you. And like I said, our lines are open at the moment. I want to make an announcement about this Friday, day after tomorrow. We have a meeting about once a month in Salinas, California, where a number of listeners and myself gather in a home in Salinas, California, and we discuss the Bible. We discuss things like we do on this program. People raise questions, and we discuss them back and forth, a room full of people. It's like the radio program, except with more people involved at the same time, and it goes longer. It's a very informal meeting. People can come and go, but it's something we've been doing for a long time. We do this once a month in Santa Cruz, California. We do it once a month in Salinas, and we do it a little less frequently up in Camas, Washington. We'll be going up to Camas, Washington about 2 weeks from now, 2.5 weeks. We'll be doing the same thing up there for our Portland area listeners. These things only happen once a month, and the one in Salinas is this Friday, August 25th, at 7 in the evening. If you live in or near Salinas or in the Monterey Bay area in general and would like to participate in this, what you need to do, if you've never been to these meetings and don't know where they are, you can call for directions. You call this number. It's area code 831, and the number is 783-1445. Again, the number is 783-1445 for directions to that gathering this Friday night in Salinas, California. If you did not get that number and you'd like to get it, you can find it at our website, thenarrowpath.com. Just like the name of the show, thenarrowpath.com. And when you get there, there's lots of places you can link to. One of the prominent links is called Announcements. And you can go there from time to time, anytime you want to, and see where I'll be speaking, if I'm speaking in your area or not. You can see, because my speaking dates for the next few months are up there. All right, so that's this Friday night in Salinas. We've got some lines occupied with callers who want to talk to us. We've got one line open. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090 if you'd like to be on the program. Our first caller today is Gina calling from Scotts Valley, California. Gina, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. My question today concerns a story in the book of Judges.
Yeah.
And
near the end?
And unfortunately, I can't find the reference right now, but one of the gentlemen in there makes a vow to God that whatever comes through the door, he'll sacrifice to God.
Right.
And it ends up being his daughter. And so he says, well, you know, I've already made this promise to God. And so he ends up sacrificing his daughter to God.
Right. Well, maybe he does. That's chapter 11, and that's Jephthah, the gentleman you're talking about.
Yeah.
He was one of the judges, a Gileadite. And he went to war against Israel's enemies to deliver them from the people of Ammon. And he made a vow when he went to war and said, if God will deliver these enemies into my hand and, you know, give me the victory, then I will sacrifice to you whatever comes first meets me coming out of my house. Now, there's a problem with the interpretation, because what he says is, whatever comes out of my house to meet me will be the Lord's, and I will offer it as a burnt offering. Now, some people think, some scholars think, that it's to be understood, rather, that he's saying, it shall surely be the Lord's, or I will offer it as a burnt offering. That's verse 31 of Judges 11. Now, I don't know if that possible change is correct. If it is, it simplifies things more. Because if he said, whatever comes out of my house will be the Lord's, or I will offer it as a burnt offering, the first option would be reserved for anything unclean that came out of his house. So anything that could not be offered as a sacrifice. That would include, of course, that would include a human being, but it would also include a dog or a donkey or you know, any unclean animal that could not rightfully be sacrificed, but it could be dedicated to the Lord in the sense that it's given to the temple for service there. Samuel, for example, as a child was dedicated to the Lord. his mother gave him to the Lord, and he wasn't sacrificed, but he went and worked all his life at the tabernacle. So that was possibly what he's saying, that he didn't know what would meet him coming out of the house. He certainly knew that there were certain things that
right.
could not be offered as sacrifices to God. A pig, for example, could not be, or a dog, or any unclean animal, and certainly a human being could not be. And so his vow might have been giving two options. If it is something that meets me that can be sacrificed, let's say a lamb or a calf or something like that, then I will offer it as a burnt offering. Otherwise, whatever meets me will just be the Lord's. That is, I'll dedicate it to the Lord. Now, there are some, many, in fact, scholars who believe that that's what happened to his daughter, that she couldn't be offered as a sacrifice.
Right.
And so he dedicated her to the Lord. There are others who say, no, the wording doesn't allow that, and we must assume that he sacrificed her. And that's really going to be a dispute that people will have probably until we go to heaven and find out, because the wording is ambiguous. All it says, as far as him carrying out his vow, was that he did carry out his vow. But whether that means he offered her as a sacrifice or simply, was dedicated to the Lord, we don't know. See, all we're told that he did in verse 39 is he carried out his vow with her that he had vowed,
right.
And she never knew a man. So it says that this girl, when she heard about the vow and what was going to be done to her, she made a request that she could, in verse 37, that she could go out and spend some time alone or with her friends, I forget which, to bewail her virginity. Yeah, her friends and she. Now, her virginity, it doesn't say bewail my life, the fact that I'm going to die, but bewail the fact that I'm going to never be a mother.
Right.
I'm going to be dedicated to the Lord forever, and I won't have a husband. I'll be a virgin all my life, which is a fine thing to do if you do that by choice, but if you're forced to it, it's not always a desirable thing, so it's something for her to mourn. So there is that other option. There are some people who think that in the period of the judges, the law was so unknown to the Jews. The Jews were so out of touch with what God had said that they did such things as offer their children as sacrifices, and that maybe that's what Jephthah did. But I think the wording is it possibly suggests that rather he just dedicated her to the Lord, and that's it. And she went to serve in the tabernacle like Samuel did as a child. Again, I don't know that we can ever know for sure which happened. And we can hope for the second.
Well, and I guess my concern when I read it was I was just thinking that if he did sacrifice her, that couldn't have in any way be sanctioned by God.
No, you're right. If he had sacrificed his daughter, that would have been a wrong thing to do. And many things in the book of Judges that were done,
right.
Even by the judges, were wrong things. Samson was a judge, and he, hung out with a prostitute, and he touched unclean things, and he broke his Nazarite vow, and so forth. So the judges were not necessarily represented in Scripture as exceptional holy men.
I see.
They were simply courageous men who decided to lead their people to victory against their oppressors. Now, interestingly enough, Samson, who I just mentioned, and Jephthah, who we've been talking about, are mentioned as examples of faith in the book of Hebrews in chapter 11. It mentions that they were men of faith. But a man of faith isn't always a man who makes all the right decisions.
Yeah.
Abraham is certainly eminent for his faith in Scripture, and yet his lying about his wife being his sister and so forth are not exactly, in my opinion, commendable behaviors. Even Rahab is recommended for her faith in Hebrews 11, but she was a harlot. And she lied and so forth. So it's not necessarily saying those are good behaviors.
Perfect. Well, thanks for your response today, Steve.
All right. Good to hear from you.
Have a good day.
God bless you, Gina. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. There was another caller from Salinas on the line. That caller did not remain, and we have lines open for you right now at 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090. 5090. Our listener has written in and asked, what does the Bible say about dinosaurs? Where do they fit in to the story in Genesis? Well, this question comes up from time to time, and the answer to it is not as difficult as one might think, unless you are influenced by the propaganda of evolution there's really not a problem at all. The propaganda of evolution says that the dinosaurs lived and died many tens of millions of years ago and became extinct 70 million years ago in the late Cretaceous period. And of course, humans had not yet evolved at that time. And so the creation story, where we find man and the animals being created, seems to be much more recent than the time of the dinosaurs, because the dinosaurs are allegedly tens of millions of years old, and when they were here. Now, we don't have to go along with that at all. There's absolutely no proof whatsoever that dinosaurs died off 70 million years ago, or even that anything was alive, or that the planet necessarily existed 70 million years ago. It may have, but different interpretations of Genesis have been offered to try to reconcile it with what various theories scientists have about the age of the Earth. I'm not concerned about that, but I would say that the dinosaurs, we need to remember that when we use the word dinosaurs, we're thinking of a special class of mysterious beings that we don't see anymore, and that they're almost the only encounter we have with them is from science fiction movies and so forth, and they don't seem like they belong to the normal animal kingdom. But in their lifetime, they did. When the dinosaurs were around, they were just animals. There were marine, that is aquatic dinosaurs. There were flying dinosaurs, and there were terrestrial, land-dwelling dinosaurs. And we read in the book of Genesis that on the fifth day, God made all the creatures that dwell in the sea and all the creatures that fly through the air. Now, that would include fish in the sea and mammals in the sea, like whales and dolphins and such, and also reptiles that were in the sea, whether they're sea turtles or marine dinosaurs, plesiosaurs and so forth. And as far as the creatures that fly in the air, that would include birds and bats and flying reptiles, what we might call pterodons or pterodactyls or whatever, Ramphorhynchus, some of the various flying dinosaurs, no doubt. I mean, they were simply in the class of animals that dwell in these ecozones, ecospheres. You see, the Bible doesn't divide the animals very neatly into the kinds of classes that we do today of, you know, mammals, reptiles, amphibia, fish, etc. Instead, it divides animals into the ecosphere where they live, those that live in the sea, those that fly in the air, and those that live on land. And the animals that lived on land were made on the sixth day prior to the creation of man on the same day. And the seagoing and arboreal animals were created on the fifth day. Now, since dinosaurs were animals, and they all lived in one or another of these ecospheres, then we'd have to say that the dinosaurs that lived in the sea and flew in the air were created at the same time as all the other animals that lived in those zones. And that the terrestrial dinosaurs, they were created when all the other terrestrial animals were created. There's really nothing scientific that would prove this to be a falsehood. And there are, you know, a number of reasons. I won't give them all right now. There are book-length treatments of them that I've read, and I could give them if I wanted to take the time. But there are reasons to believe that dinosaurs and man have lived side by side on the Earth at a certain point in time. It's true that the dinosaurs don't seem to be with us anymore, though we can't even be 100% sure of that. For one thing, a plesiosaur, apparently, a 30-foot-long sea-going reptile, which is usually referred to as a dinosaur, had its carcass hauled aboard a fishing boat back in 1977. They photographed it, and because it was rotting, because it had died recently, they threw it overboard because they didn't want it to spoil the catch of fish. But once the photograph was published, they got in a lot of trouble for throwing it overboard because it looked like a dinosaur. And yet it was a corpse that had not been very long dead. It was rotting, but it still had plenty of flesh on it. And it's clear that it was a recently dead animal. And so it would appear that there may be more in the sea than we know about. It is sometimes said that the depths of the sea we know less about than we know about the dark side of the moon. And it's hard to know exactly what all is down there. We know this, that for decades, scientists were saying that the coelacanth fish, which they thought was the ancestor of the first land amphibians. And they thought it had died off and become extinct 200 million years ago. And that was the standard scientific opinion. The coelacanth was extinct for 200 million years. However, they began catching them alive off the coast of Madagascar a couple decades ago, and now they've caught a couple dozen of them at least, and they know very well that they're not extinct. Although it was the position that they were extinct, they believe they died out long before the dinosaurs ever arrived, and yet these fish are alive today. And so to say that dinosaurs are extinct is simply a faith statement. We don't know that they are, and, you know, when you find a corpse of a recently dead dinosaur, in 1977, the picture was published in Newsweek magazine. That's where I saw it. Since then, it's been republished in a number of books. Certainly raises questions as to whether all the dinosaurs truly are gone or not. If they are around, they certainly are rare. But then there's a lot of rare species of critters that we don't see very often, and perhaps some we've never seen yet. So as far as dinosaurs go, they are animals, obviously. They were probably reptiles, although some scientists are not sure they'd want to call them reptiles, but we'll call them that. The word dinosaur itself means terrible lizard, suggesting at least the original theories that they're reptiles. And therefore, they were apparently created when other reptiles were in the various spheres where they lived. All right, let's go back to the phones now. We'll talk to Mark, who's calling from Monterey, California. If you have a call, a question you'd like to ask, or a point you'd like to make, feel free to give me a call. We have lines open at 1-800-438-5090. The program you're listening to is The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and our caller is Mark from Monterey. Hello, Mark. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello, Steve. I have a question, if you could maybe clear this up for me. As a Christian, when we die, of course, to be absent from the body is to be present with God. Now, is that, if you just clear this whole thing up, to be present with God is our spirit, which is, I don't know what type of form that is, would be present with God. And then when Jesus comes, when we come back to the earth, is that when we attain a glorified body? Or how does this whole process work?
Okay. Now, first of all, I should let you know before I give my answer that theories abound about this. Some people believe in soul sleep. And they believe that when we die, our spirit does not go to be with the Lord, but we just go into a period of unconsciousness. And we arise from that on the resurrection when Jesus returns. Others believe, as I tend to, that our spirit, our conscious life, goes to be with God in heaven when we die and remains there until the resurrection. Now, it's clear that when Paul talks about being absent from the body, but present with the Lord, which he speaks of in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and also in Philippians chapter 1, he's talking about something that is me, that is absent from my body. It's clear there's a distinction made between my body and me. If I can be absent from my body, then my body is simply the home in which I am living. And I must be something other than my body. I take that to mean my human personhood, my soul or my spirit or whatever. I don't know which word to use because Paul doesn't distinguish at this point. He simply indicates that the time, he says in 2 Corinthians 5 that as long as we are at home in the body, he says we are absent from the Lord. But he says we would be very glad, he says, to be absent from the body and in the presence of the Lord. So it sounds like we are at home in a body. Who are we then? Well, we must be a soul or something like that. Must be something immaterial that is us, our personality, our mind, our psyche, whatever. It lives in a body. It's at home in the body. And as long as we're at home in the body, in a certain sense, we're not with God. I mean, God is everywhere, but we are living here, and he actually has his primary abode in heaven. So when we die, Paul indicates, we are absent from the body. That doesn't just mean that the body turns off the lights and no one's home and there's no consciousness until the resurrection and no one knows where they are anymore until the resurrection happens. It indicates that there's something that is me that vacates and is absent from the body and is at that time present with the Lord. And Paul uses that expression twice in his writing, so it seems to be, you know, his standard understanding of things. Now, the body, of course, at death does not go to be with the Lord. The body is material and goes into the ground and it decomposes. The second law of thermodynamics does its work on the body and it goes back to the dust, as God told Adam that he would go back to the dust upon his death. But this separation between the body and the person at death is not permanent because the Bible makes it very clear when Jesus comes back, He is going to raise the body, reconstitute it, glorify it, and that will be at the second coming. But it says this in 1 Thessalonians 4:14. He says, "For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so will God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus." Now, he will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. That sounds to me like he's saying that when Jesus comes, he's going to bring with him those who have died, who are Christians. And if he's going to bring them with him, it strongly suggests they have been with him in the intervening period, and he's going to bring them back to raise them from the dead, because he says this in verse 16, "For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel and the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first." So at the second coming, the dead will rise. "Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And thus we shall always be with the Lord." So there's, at the time of the second coming, the dead who have died in Christ will be raised. But it says that God will bring them with Jesus when he comes, apparently. That's how I understand it. I could be understanding it incorrectly, because we don't have very many verses that explain it.
Right. When he says, what you just said, we're asleep with him, those who sleep, that would, I mean, we could say if we're with him in an unconscious type of way, and then when we come back, that then we receive our glorified body. And
well, that, some could say it. Yeah, some could say it that way if they wish to. I myself don't think that the word sleep is speaking of unconsciousness.
Okay.
I mean, when I'm asleep, I'm not unconscious.
Right.
I'm just not, you know, when I'm asleep, I'm in another world. But I'm experiencing something. My mind is alive. I'm dreaming. Things are going on. There's characters. There's activity. There's awareness. It's just not an awareness of the actual geographical position my body's sleeping in. What's going on in the room around me, I'm unaware of, but I'm aware of a different realm that I'm in when I'm asleep. So, I mean, sleep does not necessarily suggest a state of unconsciousness at all. It does suggest that you are not conscious of what's going on where your body is. And that, yet, I think the reason for using the metaphor of sleep is to not so much speak of the consciousness or unconsciousness of the condition, but to speak of the temporariness of the condition of death. Because a person who's asleep is in a condition that is temporary, from which they will awaken.
Right.
And when God chooses the metaphor of sleep for death, what he's addressing is, apart from any divine revelation, we would assume that death is permanent. When a person dies, we've never seen them come back yet. I mean, some people have, because there have been a few cases of people rising from the dead, but, you know, 99.9999% of human beings have never seen anyone rise from the dead. And because of that, it seems, conventional wisdom would say death is the end. Death is it's permanent. It's over. But when God uses the term sleep to refer to death, he's referring to the fact that just as a person goes to sleep, but then they wake up again, and we expect them to wake up again, so also when someone dies, we should expect that they will arise again. As a person arises from sleep again, so the body will rise again. But I don't think it's talking about the conscious state or unconscious state of the dead when it uses the metaphor of sleep. Because, as I said, sleep is not necessarily a state of unconsciousness.
Yes. Well, thank you.
Yeah, well, you're welcome. I hope that clears things up. So whatever, now, again, there are listeners here who have different views of all this, and that's fine. I don't really see why it's even very important to know the answer. But I do know why we're curious, because we all expect to die, or we know someone who has died, and it's obviously a matter of curiosity to us. But it's not an important matter in terms of our salvation or our Christian living.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
But it's a valid question. Thank you, Mark.
Bye.
God bless you. Bye-bye. All right, our lines are open right now for you. If you'd like to be on the program, we've got less than a half hour left, but that's plenty of time for a question or two or three or four, depending on the depth of the question and the length of time it takes to answer it. But we have our lines open at 1-800-438-5090, 1-800-438-5090. Tomorrow is Thursday, and Thursday nights, typically, we have a weekly gathering in Soquel, California. That's right outside Santa Cruz, where I live. And that meeting is a Bible study, a Bible teaching that I give on the book of Acts. We're going verse by verse through the book of Acts rather slowly. We've had 25 lectures in this series so far, and we've only gotten halfway through Chapter 9. But we are moving right along, and we've just covered the conversion of Saul. We'll be talking about the early years of Saul. By the way, if you've ever tried to sort it out, what happened in the first few years after Saul's conversion? That's what we'll be talking about tomorrow night at our study in the book of Acts, because in the book of Galatians, Paul tells some of the early history of his life after his conversion, and it doesn't really follow the material given in Acts chapter 9 about the same period of time, which has led some people to think there's a contradiction between Galatians and Acts. I certainly don't think so at all, but I can see why people think that, and we'll talk about that in detail tomorrow night. The Book of Acts study in Soquel, the meeting is held in the facilities graciously provided by the Lighthouse Christian Fellowship in Soquel. The address is 4525 Soquel Drive. That's 4525 Soquel Drive in Soquel, California, every Thursday night at 7 o'clock, including tomorrow night. All right, we're going to go back to the phones and talk to Homer, who's calling from Brownsville, Oregon, and we'll get to Wallace and Pastor Robles next after that. Hello, Homer. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
How you doing, Steve?
Great to hear from you.
Yes. No stop off in Albany in September, huh?
No, actually, the home we usually meet in is not going to be available. There's a baby being born there around that time.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right. So I just had a matter of curiosity to ask about today. When do you think the apostles were baptized?
Oh, that's a good question. I believe probably most of them, if not all of them, were probably baptized by John the Baptist, but as we know, Paul, in Romans 19, did not consider that the baptism of John the Baptist was the same thing as Christian baptism.
Right.
And so, whenever they received Christian baptism, I don't know. It says in John chapter 4 that Jesus baptized no one except the apostles, and the statement is unclear. Does this mean that Jesus only baptized the apostles and no one else? Or does it mean that Jesus didn't baptize anyone at all, only the apostles were commissioned to do that on his behalf?
Uh-huh.
It's an ambiguous statement. It's in like John 4, verse 2 or so.
Uh-huh.
And, one possible meaning of that would be that Jesus baptized the apostles, but he didn't baptize anyone else. Apparently the apostles did the rest of the baptizing. And that, no matter how that verse is taken, that's probably the correct scenario. Probably Jesus did baptize the apostles when he met them, but we don't have any record of it. And that's interesting, too, because as important as baptism seems to be in general in the New Testament, it's rather surprising that the call of the apostles and their transition from being simply Jewish people into being Christian people is never marked by at least the record of their baptism.
Yeah, that's rather odd. If Jesus did baptize them, though, seemingly Christian baptism is in regard to being baptized into Jesus' death.
Yeah.
And if he had not died yet, that would seem that wouldn't fit, really.
That's a good point. And so possibly he may have baptized them, after his resurrection. But
right.
We don't know. We simply can't say. I mean, he did meet with them at the Sea of Galilee that time in John chapter 21, at least with seven of them. It's possible he baptized them there, but we'd be reading much too much between the lines if we were to insist on it.
Right. I think we have to assume that they were baptized at some point because, even Jesus insisted that he must be baptized himself.
Right. And he was baptized before his own death.
Right.
But it's possible that his baptism anticipated his death and resurrection.
Right.
And ours reflects back on it, yeah.
I was just thinking maybe they were baptized on the day of Pentecost with everybody else.
Well, that is possible, too. I mean, they'd have to baptize each other, but that's what the first Anabaptists did.
Right.
Back in the early 1500s. Everybody had been baptized as a baby, and there wasn't anyone practicing believer baptism, and so the first people who believed in it, again, after the apostles' time, they just baptized each other.
Right. Just a matter of curiosity, I guess. No great importance to it. But.
Well, I'm sure you have as much insight into it as I do, because I mean, we don't have actual information on it.
Yeah. And so both of us have none.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so, I mean, I think you're right. We have to assume they were baptized because they insist that that's an important thing for Christians to be, but we, for some reason, don't have any specific reference to them being baptized.
Right. Okay, I'll let you go, brother.
Okay, Homer. I hope to see you sometime soon.
Yeah, I hope so. God bless.
God bless you. Bye-bye. All right, we'll talk next to Wallace, who's calling from Paso Robles, California. If you'd like to be on the program, we have lines open. You can get on one, get on hold. We'll talk to you in the next few minutes. If you have a question from the Bible or maybe a difference of opinion from the host you'd like to express, the number is 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090. Wallace, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. I'm interested in your show a lot. I listen off and on when I'm out in the car. Primarily because you don't even get a good reception here in Paso.
Yeah, you're pretty far away. Paso Robles is pretty far away from Salinas.
Yes. The question is, God knows everything. Well, that's a statement of fact, first of all. And if he knows everything, then he knew, well, first of all, he created Satan, and he knew that they would fall in the Garden of Eden. Is that reasonable?
That he knew Adam and Eve would fall in the Garden of Eden?
Yes.
Yes, uh-huh.
Yes. So that this whole thing about each one of us coming to our own salvation. Actually, he knows the way that's going. I'm not preaching predestination or anything like that.
Right.
But
right.
It's just curious to me that this whole plan for God to get us into his family is that the ones that do come to his salvation are willingly doing this. Because he doesn't want people around him who don't want to be there.
Right.
So it just seems though, you know, somehow I'm glad that I'm saved, but I didn't know whether it was already determined for me to do that.
Well, it's a good question, and there's a number of different ways people have answered it. At one pole of thinking, there are the people who hold to openness theology. And some of these are very good evangelical scholars, and they've got a biblical case that they make. I haven't bought their conclusions at this point. But they make a very interesting case, and it's not irresponsible. They say that when the Bible says that God knows everything, it means, of course, he knows everything that there is to know. But the future doesn't exist yet, and it's not there to know. And so it's no slight on God's omniscience to say that God doesn't know what choices people are going to make before they make them. Because that simply doesn't exist as information to be known at all. It's non-existent. The future hasn't happened yet. And therefore, they say that God's omniscience only means that he knows everything that is happening right now. He knows everything that has ever happened. He knows everything that's going on anywhere in the universe. And he even is, of course, wise enough, certainly far wiser than men, in order to make predictions about what, you know, the trajectory of present circumstances may result in the future. And he knows what things he's going to bring about in the future by his own sovereign choice, but they say he doesn't know what people are going to decide before they decide it. And they say this is not a diminishing of the doctrine of omniscience, because, and this is how it's often said, when we say that God can do everything, when we talk about his omnipotence, that doesn't mean he can do ridiculous things like, can God cease to exist? I don't think so, you know. The Bible specifically says God can't lie. God can't deny himself, it says. God cannot be tempted with evil. There's certain things God can't do because they're simply contrary to himself and to reality. And therefore, it is sometimes said that even though God can do all things, that doesn't mean that he could make absurdity be true. He couldn't make 2 plus 2 equal 5. He couldn't make a circle be a square. Without changing the definition of a circle. You know, these are absurdities. These are illogical. And while some people think that they preserve a higher view of God by saying that God can do everything, including absurdities, that's not necessarily a position the Bible takes. The Bible does say that there are things God cannot do. He cannot deny himself. He can't act contrary to himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so that there clearly the doctrine of God's omnipotence, that is the doctrine that he can do everything, has certain implied limitations, and some of the limitations are even stated in Scripture. But that doesn't impugn the doctrine of his omnipotence. And they say, the openness people say, we need to go the same route with the doctrine of omniscience. To say that God knows everything means, of course, everything that is to be known. But the future doesn't exist yet, and therefore it can't be known, especially if there's true freedom of choice. Tomorrow, in the face of a temptation, I may choose to successfully resist it, or I might choose to succumb in sin. And they say, since that choice has not been made by me yet, and it's entirely a free choice for me to make when the time happens, it's an undetermined thing. It doesn't exist yet. There's nothing there to know, because there's no information there, you know, for anyone to know, because it hasn't happened. That's how the openness people talk about such things, and they point out a number of places in the Bible where they talk about God changing his mind about things, and times where he seems to profess ignorance about certain things. My own interpretation of those passages differs from theirs, and I'm not in their camp. But I would say this, that those who hold that view often do so for very responsible exegetical reasons, and there's no reason why such people should not be considered evangelicals, because they respect the Bible and they're seeking to interpret the Bible as best they know how, and I think that they have a case. They just haven't convinced me yet. Then there's, on the other extreme, is the Calvinist or the Augustinian view, and that's the view that God not only knows all the future, but the reason he knows it is because he's determined it. He has ordained everything that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And therefore, they say that he ordained that Adam and Eve would sin. He ordained that you and I will sin tomorrow if we do. Or if we don't sin, he ordained that too. He ordained that a certain number of people would receive Christ. He ordained that the other people would not. And, you know, everything that is done, everything that ever happens has been preordained or predetermined by God. And therefore, of course, God knows what's going to happen. He's got all pre-written. It's all scripted. And so that's the other extreme. So the openness people at one extreme say God doesn't know because God doesn't cause us to make certain choices. The other extreme, Calvinism, says God does know because God does cause us to do it. And in the middle of those two is the Arminian position, which is what I've basically historically held to and seem to at this point as well. And that is that God does somehow know all future things, but he knows it without being the cause of it. God has some access to information about the future that is not easy for us to grasp. Some people say that God lives outside of time, and that all of what we call history and time are like a line drawn on a sheet of paper, but God's the whole sheet of paper, and he sees the beginning and the end of the line all at the same time, so that he's essentially timeless. Now, arguments can be made against this assumption, the first of which is the Bible does not tell us that God lives outside of time. That's a philosophical suggestion, and it may not be correct. But if it is correct, it would explain, for example, how God could know the future without being its cause. He simply is viewing it. Someone compared it with a parade coming down the street. Those people who are standing on the sidewalk see one float and one marching band at a time going by. But if you went up in a helicopter over the whole thing, you could see the beginning and the end of the parade and all the parts in between in one glance. And they say that that's how God sees all of history. Now, this theory cannot be proven to be true because the Bible doesn't tell us that it's true. And some people find it logically difficult. But it is the position more or less that Arminians take. They take that God truly does not cause what I will do, but he knows what I will do. Now, here's what both the openness people and the Calvinist people say against the Arminians. The Arminians in the middle, he gets shot at from both sides. And both sides make the same objection to Arminianism. They say, if God knows for sure what's going to happen, then it must be determined. Because God certainly can't, God cannot know that I am or am not going to sin tomorrow unless that's determined.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he knows it, then it can't happen any other way than what he knows is going to happen. And therefore, I'm not free to do something else. Now, that is the logic of both the openness theology and the Calvinist theology. The Calvinists solve it by saying, true, I don't have free will. It is determined. God knows it because it's determined. The openness people says, no, it isn't determined, therefore God doesn't know it. The Arminian stands in the awkward position in the middle and says, well, God does know it, but it's not determined. At least not determined by God. Here's where I would here's what I would say, and this may not be true. This is just how I think. You know, there's obviously different theories available. I believe that in some respect, what I'm going to do is determined, but not by God. It's determined by me. I haven't gotten to the point in my life yet where I'm going to do it, but my choice is going to determine it.
Absolutely.
And God knows what my choice is going to be. And it's not going to be anything other than what it is. So in one sense, it is determined. Though when I get to that point in time, I'll still be making that choice freely. But it's sort of like, if we just take the word, think of the word destiny. You know, it's your destiny, Luke. You know, well, what is your destiny? Well, your destiny is simply what's going to happen to you. You know, is it your destiny to live long and die in your sleep, or is it your destiny to get killed in an automobile accident tomorrow? We don't know. But something is going to happen to you in the rest of your life, and whatever that is your destiny. Now, that destiny may not be determined by God entirely. It may be partly determined by God's sovereign intervention, and partly decided by choices you make, and partly decided by other people's choices.
Yeah.
But whatever it is, whatever that complex reality is, we can just put a tag on it and call that's your destiny. That's what's going to happen to you. And that is what's going to happen. And for God to know that that's what's going to happen doesn't make him the active cause of it any more than if he didn't know.
Yeah. I was praying for a friend of mine that he would come to salvation, and he was resisting, and he still does. So I remembered that when I came to the Lord, I came through a whole lot of adversity. So I started praying adversity into his life. And God got all over me about that and said, I don't do that. You do that to yourselves.
Hmm. Well, God does bring adversity sometimes, the Bible indicates, but it shouldn't be our... We shouldn't decide that God must bring adversity on somebody that we're praying for, because God knows best whether they should be reached by his goodness or his severity.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a debate that will go on. I certainly don't believe that the Calvinist view is correct. I am not convinced that the Openness view is correct in standing in between in the Arminian position. I am pretty much where I've stood virtually all of my life on this
position. I like
this
position, by the way. I think that's rational.
It might be. Some people say it isn't.
But it's rational.
Well, it's not unscriptural. Let's put it that way. You know, it's any view of this is going to be extra biblical. That is, it's based on something outside the Bible, and many people, of course, read it into biblical passages.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I'm not saying that my view is the most logical. I'm not saying it's the most scriptural. I'm just saying that as near as I can tell, it satisfies the data of Scripture the best I know. The best way I know to do it.
And it's wonderful. I'm in agreement with you, so that's the reason I think it's wonderful.
All right. Well, I appreciate
one
your call, my friend.
I don't know if you've been watching it, any of the public television stuff, but they've had stuff on here lately about the string theory. Have you heard
of it? I don't have a television, so I haven't seen any of that stuff.
Well, the string theory is supposedly a theory that combines Einstein's theory of relativity and the quantum mechanics.
Uh-huh. Now, I've heard of it. I don't know much about it.
Theory of relativity deals with big things like gravity and planets and space and light and all that sort of thing. Quantum mechanics deals with the small things, the quarks,
subatomic particles. Yeah.
Yes. Well, the string theory is supposed to put all of this together. The trouble is that they have five string theories. And these mathematicians are so wonderful. You know, they say, but the math is so eloquent. I don't know how we could be wrong. And I'm getting a big kick out of it. Now they've come up with a new M theory, which combines all five of the string theories together so that they now can figure out how all of this was created. Well, you know, they've got the Big Bang Theory down to the point now where they say, well, we know that it happened because we can play the movie backwards, and we can tell based on the space of that's being covered by the galaxies and all that, we can move it back in time to just a few seconds before it happened.
Mm-hmm.
They still don't know what happened there. But the thing that they're missing, they're counting up, like you were talking about the dinosaurs, they're counting up all of these millions of years that it took for this to happen. And I said, you know what? They just don't know what God's time schedule is. They got their time all wrong. Just because we're in that kind of a time frame doesn't say God is. And that's...
Well, of course, the problem with science, although science has many things about it that are not problems, I mean, science has been very beneficial to man in many ways, but there is a limitation on it, and the problem is that scientists often don't acknowledge that limitation. And that limitation is that science can only discuss observable things
yes.
that happen in the material world.
Yeah.
Now because science is only designed to discuss observable, repeatable material phenomena, some scientists get so provincial in their thinking they think that nothing exists outside of that realm that science studies.
Yes.
And then it becomes their religion.
Yeah.
They embrace the religion of naturalism, which of course is essentially atheism, and so they decide simply by an illogical leap that the realm that their disciplines are studying is the only realm there is to know.
Mm-hmm.
And because science can only study the observable natural world, they just decide that's the only world there is. Well, of course, science can't tell you whether the natural world is the only world that is. It can only observe the natural world. It doesn't know whether other worlds exist and can't even address the question.
Yeah,
but unfortunately, they often try to. Yeah.
In the string theory, they say there's 12 dimensions, so that they can't figure it out. And the other thing they even admit to is that because of the fact that the strings are so small, they'll never be able to see them, so it's not really a theory, it's a philosophy.
Yeah, well, because that's the way it is with a lot of science. A lot of science boils down to philosophy.
Yeah.
It does. I mean, philosophy isn't a negative word either. I mean, philosophy is wisdom. You know, I mean, there's such a thing as knowledge, which is what the word science means. Science means knowledge. And philosophy means love of wisdom. And wisdom and knowledge are not the same thing. You know, knowledge is what you can observe and know for sure. Wisdom is how you apply that and integrate it into a whole system.
Yes.
And so the philosophy is a little more subjective than the knowledge part.
Yeah.
So even naturalism or materialism or atheism, those are in the realm of philosophy.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, many scientists treat it as if it's part of science.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to suck up any more of your time with this esoteric stuff.
Yeah, well, I got another call I want to take before I'm done. I only have a few minutes left. I enjoy
Thank
talking
you
with you.
Much.
You can call again.
Oh, I will. Talk to you
God
later.
Bless you, Wallace.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Let's talk to Gus from Greenfield, California next. And Gus, I think you're probably our last caller today, so welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. I'm actually calling for my son. He's a 9-year-old, and he wanted to know, as far as dinosaurs, what time period did they existed before Adam and Eve or after Adam and Eve, and if Adam and Eve encountered them. Maybe if you could speak to him, he's listening to you on the radio. And could I take this call off there?
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Okay.
God bless you. Bye-bye. Well, as I said earlier in the program, actually dinosaurs were animals, and because they were animals, they were created when other animals were. All the animals that lived in the sea and that flew in the air and that lived on land, which, as far as we know, are all the places that animals have ever lived. We don't know of any that live in space. They were all created on the fifth and sixth days of creation in Genesis chapter 1. Now, that is prior to Adam and Eve, but not very much prior. That is, Adam and Eve were also created last, but they were created the same day as the other land animals. Now, there are different theories that Christians have had about whether the days were regular days, or whether the word day in the scripture, at least in Genesis, is symbolic for a long period of time. We may never know for sure, but in my own understanding, it's talking about ordinary days, and that the creation week was an ordinary week of 6 days, followed by a day of rest, which God, you know, took on the seventh day. Now, the dinosaurs there were created just before Adam and Eve, and at the same time as all the other animals were created. The idea that dinosaurs lived millions of years before people, or that they lived hundreds of or tens of millions of years before people, cannot be proven from science, and it doesn't seem to agree with the Bible or even with many modern observations. I would say that there's a good chance that dinosaurs are mentioned in the book of Job. Now, Christians often point to this, those who are creationists, and it is questionable whether the creatures described here were dinosaurs or not, but they just simply, they seem like they are. And because they seem like they are, it's the theory that many Christians hold. In Job chapter 40 and in Job chapter 41, God is speaking to Job. And in the previous chapters, God has been pointing out to Job the wonders of creation, including eagles and wild horses and other ostriches and other creatures that God is describing that Job was familiar with. And now he mentions in chapter 40, he mentions a creature called Behemoth in verse 15, Job chapter 40, verse 15. And he talks about Behemoth until the end of that chapter. And then in chapter 41, he mentions a creature called Leviathan, and he describes that creature. Now, he speaks about these two creatures as if Job is as familiar with them as he is familiar with the wild horses and the eagles and the ostriches and the other animals that were mentioned. God is pointing out things about animals that were around Job and making examples of them of how wise and powerful God is if he created and controls them. So when he talks about Behemoth, and he talks about Leviathan, he expects Job and Job's contemporaries to know what he's talking about. They've seen these animals. And he describes them. The Behemoth is a very large animal that lives by the rivers and eats grass, apparently. It eats greenery. And it's apparently quite huge. And his tail, for example, is said to move like a cedar tree. And when he drinks, he practically drinks up the whole river. This is probably an exaggeration, but the point is he's got a big appetite. He eats up all the greenery on a mountainside. He's huge. It is thought by many that this is some kind of a large vegetarian style or herbivorous dinosaur. Like we normally think of, the Brachiosaurus or the Diplodocus or the Brontosaurus or something like that. And it is possible. In fact, there's actually no living animal today that fits the description that we've ever seen. And so if the description is literal or even close to literal, it would appear that it's talking about something that we would call a dinosaur if we saw it. And in chapter 41, Leviathan is more of a meat-eating creature. It's got a mouthful of sharp teeth. It's got scales. It leaves a scaly imprint on the mud by the river. It lives in the river and swims in the river. And its scales are so thick, it says, that if you try to pierce them with a spear, you'll break your spear point on them. That a spear crumbles against the scales of this creature like rotten wood would crumble. And so if you read these, it sounds as if it's talking about creatures that, it doesn't fit the description of any known animal today, but they could easily fit the description of dinosaurs if Job and his companions had ever seen dinosaurs, which they might have. There's no evidence whatsoever that would tell us that dinosaurs all died off before humans were here. And that's basically a scientific theory. It belongs to this theory of evolution, which has a lot of theoretical aspects that have never been proven, and that being one of them. So I believe the dinosaurs were made around the same time as Adam and Eve, which is at the exact same time other animals were made. That's the easiest answer I know to give you. And as far as I know, there's no evidence to disprove it. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. You can always call to disagree. If you have information I don't have and want to prove me wrong, you're welcome to do that. I'm not embarrassed to be shown wrong. I just want the truth just like you, I hope. And anyone who can bring the truth more to light is welcome here. If you'd like to keep the radio program on the air, you can help us pay the radio bills if you'd like. If God moves you to do that, that's all I want, is for you to do what God says. And if he doesn't do it, then don't do it. But you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can find that address and many resources at our website, which is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion.